Thelma. Bye, welcome. Welcome to this first long table. It was called a long table, a round table, and I see the table is the smallest part on the stage. And we still need to find a little table or something for Jean and a glass of wine, but that will come. Yeah. Baie welkom. Ek dink dit gaan 'n absoluut 'n verskriklike interessante gesprek wees en ongelooflik very very topical. I mean, we lived through the era of Zuma. We're now in the very beginnings of the era of Cyril Ramaphosa. Alexander Fuller here from America is experiencing the era of Trump. So just kind of how do you deal with the world of today with all its strife and struggles, but also beauty when you are a creative, when you write, when you use words? That is basically the topic of today. And the guy who kind of stormed in late from the airport is Jean Meyring. He's a lawyer. There was a reason why I actually chose a lawyer, because to handle all of these authors, you need someone who's quick. And that is a lawyer. So thanks so much, Jean. He's also a very well-known and much respected books reviewer. So he has his hands into books. Okay, Jean.
Thank you, Elmarie. I see that there's a senior counsel in the front row who I might, if things go difficultly, ask to come and lead me, Skulk. No, I won't do that to you. Good evening, everyone. And yes, it was rather not a well-designed, thank you, race to the finish, but oddly, all the planes from Joburg to Cape Town when I arrived at O.R. Tambo this afternoon at 2 or 2.30 were either delayed or cancelled. My travel agent, who's currently celebrating Shabbat, I have to say thank you to Shana, who got me on a virtually empty flight of Sem Air or Chem Air, the sort of minnow in the market that stepped into the breach, and it was a plane that had come from Hoedspruit, so it was sort of filled with the smell of impalas, steenbokkies, and Afrikaners, all of which, of course, was very pleasant. But at any rate, that's the reason I made this late entry. But what a pleasure to be here with this cohort of eminent creative artists this evening. Can I perhaps ask you each to just introduce yourselves in a little postcard before we start? Simon.
Hello, my name is Simon Witboe. I'm the witste boy wat jy ooit kan kry. I go by the name of Hemel Beesem, and I'm a hip-hop and Afrikaans activist. It's his day. Thank you.
My name is Janine. I'm Afrikaans of English. Now, well, ik weet niet wat ik om te swing toe nie. Maar ik is Janine, ook bekend als die kunstenaar Black Pearl, and that's Black with a Q. Ik schrijf van de ouderdom van 12 en ik is van Mitchell's Plain Beacon Valley op die so-called Cape Flats. En ik is een professional performing artist in music, theater, storytelling, poetry. En ik doe goed zoals die part-time work. Dank u.
I'm Alexandra Fuller, and I am primarily a memoirist. And I grew up in what is now Zimbabwe, Zambia, Malawi. And I've lived in the States nearly as long as I lived in Southern Africa. So I'm split.
But your accent is obviously not nearly as convincing as Charlize's.
Yet.
Hi, my name is Fred Kumalo. I'm a literary schizophrenic of some sort. I'm a journalist, short story writer, novelist, memoirist, and otherist in between. I'm here to talk primarily about my latest novel, which is The Dancing the Death Drill, which reimagines the sinking of the SS Mendi during the First World War.
Goeienaand. My name is Marita van der Vijver. I'm even more schizophrenic than Fred next to me because I write novels for adults, for children, for YA fiction, memoirs, very wide. I've even written 2 cookbooks, believe it or not. So I'm also trying to survive as an Afrikaans writer living in France. It's not always makkelijk nie, maar ja, that's me.
My name is Eben Venter, and I'm an Afrikaans novelist, and I've lived almost half of my life in Australia, and I've actually written my most recent novel in English. The title is Green as the Sky is Blue, and it'll be published by Penguin in August.
My name is Velda Jansen. Die boek wat ek geskryf het is Uitkom met die Skoenlappers, en ek kom nou agter dat almal vir my vra, is jy nou besig met jou volgende boek? So ek dink ek is, maar ek kan nou nie veel daaroor sê nie. Ek het voorheen skool gehou. Ek was 'n Duits onderwyser by Portland High in Mitchells Plain en toe weer by Guild High in die Parel. En daarna was ek joernalis by die Burger en Beeld en by RSG, en toe het ek teruggekom Kaap toe, en nou is ek 'n skrywer. Ja, en dit is wat, as mense my vra wat ek is en wat ek doen, dan sê ek, okay, ek skryf. So, kom ons kyk maar wat gaan nou volgende uitkom. Dank u.
Hello, my name is Masande Njanga. I used to be a music writer, and now I'm a short story writer and a novelist. I'm originally from the Eastern Cape, King Williamstown, and I guess I just try to document, or rather kind of distill into like literature my understanding of the society that we all share.
I'm Fani Nardia. I'm a lapsed lawyer. After having been a lawyer for about 16 years or so, I've over the last 7 years I've been writing pretty much full time. I'm a short story writer and a novelist, and my most recent novel is called The Third Reel. Did I have the spool enough?
Thank you, everyone. So we flanked on that side by a lapsed lawyer, and on this side, Simon, if I'm not mistaken, by a lapsed pastor. Pastor of all places in Worcester, but sometime after J.M. could see you, so you could do nothing to him. But it is interesting how, listening to how the participants at this long table characterize themselves. And Valda, perhaps you, the language you used was most, to me, perhaps poignant. And that is, to become a writer, it's not something like a lawyer where you have an admission in court and you know now you are a lawyer. And each of you in your own sort of specific way, on that side, Fani said he was a lapsed lawyer. At some juncture, at some point, he must have decided, well, now I am a holy of holies, a writer. Marita was a journalist. You were a hooligan before, if your memoirs are anything to go by. There are a lot of teachers and journalists, and of course being a journalist is not necessarily being a writer in the full sense of the word. So I'm intrigued to know what was there, and I'm going to perhaps start on Fani's side, reverse the trend, and ask, and perhaps because he, coming from the dark arts of lawyering, must have been the most sort of Damascene or epiphanic experience to say, well, I'm turning my back on all of that, and now I am a writer. Was there such, and I ask that of each of you, and you don't have to go strictly, you can be unruly, and you don't have to go strictly in the reverse order, but I will start with Fani. Was there a moment, and what was that moment, if there was such a moment when you realized, oh God, I'm a writer?
I'm not sure one ever quite reaches that moment. It wasn't a Damascus moment, I think. Since a reasonably young age, I've used to scribble things. Lawyering or professional career seems to be the vehicle for various other, the vehicle to get to various places that a writing career might not seem as obviously suited to, and then somewhere along the way one thinks one arrives at some sort of destination or semi-destination, doesn't quite know and don't know quite how you got there. I think for me, perhaps in the most pragmatic terms, when I was living in London after many years of being a lawyer there, in 2008 with the financial cataclysm, when there was a sense of panic in the air, that somehow in me triggered the ability to look at my life and my existence in a somewhat different way. And then I realized that there was something else I've always wanted to do. There's another place I could go back to. And then I did this very strange thing, which my colleagues in the financial world in London couldn't comprehend at all, by coming back to the southern edge, returning to the southern edge of the world, and start writing in Afrikaans at that, and literary prose at that. Yes, a very irrational thing to do.
So the only thing worse than writing in Afrikaans was the cataclysm of 2008, basically. Masande.
At which moment I felt like I was a writer?
Yes. Was there such a moment? What was that moment?
I guess I started writing pretty early. When I was young, I moved around different schools a lot. My parents were always trying to kind of move to a better neighborhood or like a place that had better schools as well. Or sometimes it just kind of was very disagreeable. So like I'd come back home and I want to go back, and then they'd indulge me. But in any case, I was always moving around, and that made it kind of difficult to be secured in any one place, right? So I found refuge a lot in reading, and it's only when I guess I'd read things that I felt kind of reflected a sensibility that I felt was mine, and it just felt like such a gift. I couldn't help but want to write, like myself. And I did that for a while, obviously kind of very amateur, very kind of in the vein of trying to mimic people that you idolize. Mm-hmm. But I kept at it, and I think for me I was lucky enough to get a story published when I was still in high school. And I was able to come to Cape Town for the launch of that journal and kind of meet with other artists. And I think for me, that was the moment. I was actually supposed to study science. And the writer who would help edit my story was like, "What are you doing? That's insane." And I was like, "I don't know. I mean, it's pretty cool to be a scientist, you know." But I carried on with that, but in terms of being a novelist, I think for me it's like Fanny said, it's an ongoing process. I mean, each time you learn all these new things in terms of like how you can structure a novel, or all these different things you can do with it. But in terms of when I felt like a novelist, I'd have to say for me was probably the point at which I got my proofs back from my publishers, and I was comfortable with the prose in the sense that it felt alien and removed enough from me to feel like, something that lived off its own and not something that I'd read and then cringe and be like, "Oh my God, why are you telling people this?"
It's a modern alchemy.
Yeah, more or less, yeah.
Alda?
I was very small. I was about 10 years old when I started writing poems. And I didn't know where it came from. It was alien. But I had that urge and I wrote. And when I explained it to people afterwards, it was like I saw the words in the air, floating in the air. And I plucked them and I wrote them down. But unfortunately, I was still very young and we did not have that history in our family of writing. So I showed it to my parents, I showed it to my father, and he indulged me, he read it. And then I wrote some more and I went to him again and I showed him more. But then he started to not believe me that it was me. So he told me that he was then very angry at one point because he thought that I was writing those things out of the newspaper or somewhere.
The worst form of plagiarism, surely.
Yes. And he threatened to hit me with the belt, with his belt. And I told him, I was standing in the corridor in our house in the Strand. And I looked him in the eyes, and I was 10 years old, and I told him, if you want to, you may hit me, if that will make you feel better. But I am telling you that I wrote those words. And then he put the belt down. And then afterwards, he brought me a book, a hardcover book, and he gave it to me and he said, I can write all my poems in there. So I took the book and I wrote the poems. But then I felt so bad. I felt broken. So I took that book and I put it in my cupboard and I left it there. And I left it there for a very long time. And I went down into myself and I told myself that what I did was not right because I wasn't believed. So every time I had that urge to write over many, many years, I suppressed it myself. And I grew up and I always had this feeling that I want to write. And I always wrote very nice essays at school, at university. I went to university and I did all these languages, I did Afrikaans and English and German and linguistics because language is my thing and words. But it took a very, very long time for me to do what it is that I feel makes me feel like somebody. Because I did all kinds of other things. I became a teacher. And then I became a journalist. And every time to work with words. And I told this to people the other day also that I used to go into bookshops and look for books. And I used to give out a lot of money to buy books. Afrikaans books. I went to that shelf for the Afrikaans books, and I bought everything and I read everything over the years, and then I realized something, that I was looking for something on that shelf, and I couldn't find it there. And then I thought to myself, but what is it? There was an uneasiness inside of me. And I thought, what am I looking for? And then I started to realize that I am looking for the book that I have to write. So I did that. So that is the book that was published 2 years ago.
Hy kom met die skoenlappers. Eben.
I was a total outsider at school, and I also, I think, like Ms. Sande, found refuge in reading. And I had a very, very good Afrikaans teacher called Charles Milan, and he introduced me to the Sestigers, and I had no heroes whatsoever. But I did think that these writers, like Etienne Leroux and Jan Rabie, that they became my heroes, and I thought one day when I'm big, I would like to write like them. And I always made notes from that time onwards. During my army days, I always made notes. And then eventually I thought, I'm ready now to write my first collection of short stories. And when I migrated to Australia in 1986, I became a chef. And I had two restaurants, and but for me that was always a means, a middle tot a doel. So I always I was able to finance my writing sabbaticals in that way, and then I wrote my first novel in Ireland.
Marita.
Ek kan nie onthou dat ek ooit enigiets anders as 'n skrywer wou wees nie. Always wanted to be a writer, and I don't know where it comes from. Ek is glad nie uit 'n familie met skrywers of kunstenaars of enigiets nie. My mother was a nurse, my father worked for the bank, my one opa was a policeman and the other opa a postman. So working class, Afrikaans, it was really weird, but I just always knew I wanted to do that. And I was a very timid child, so I could never tell the teachers or my friends or anybody that I had this impossible dream to become a writer. So I decided I can become a journalist because it's a stepping stone. I actually, afterwards, I justified it by saying I had to learn to write the truth, if you can call journalism the truth, because I actually wanted to tell lies. I wanted to write fiction, always. And I started in school, and I wasn't into poetry and things like that, but I discovered Ankie Krog when I was about 16 years old, and she wasn't much older then. Mm. She's written her first collection of poetry as a schoolgirl. And suddenly, I thought, Afrikaanse gedigte is geskryf deur dooie wit mans. Dit gaan oor dinge, mense wat doodgaan op plase. And then I suddenly realized, wow, jy kan Afrikaanse gedigte kan ook oor met my praat. And I was the poor man's Ankie Krog. I got a bursary to study at Stellenbosch with three poems that I wrote in the style of Ankie Krog. I got to D. Opperman's laboratory, and I decided, no, my poetry is too bad. I must do something else. And toe ek begin ander goed skryf, but it took me quite a few. I studied quite a few books because I started very young. My first book was published when I was 22. Jeugdliteratuur, youth, because I felt I don't know, I can't write to grown-ups. Everything over 30 was old. But I could vividly remember what it was like being 16. So I started, and then by about the age of 30, my excuses ran out. I tackled adult fiction. It took me many years, and I was quoted that to call myself a writer without, sonder om aan my neus te raak verlee. Because I still have that. After all these years, writers to me are groot mense.
big people. Shakespeare is a writer. So I still have a little bit of that Afrikaanse meisie wat nie eintlik al glo dat sy nou skrywer geword.
Were those poems ever published?
No, God, no. I lost the book. Sometimes I think it would have been nice if it was in a little blue book, but no. Some things are best hidden. Some things should stay in the drawer.
Perhaps in some archive somewhere, the bursary giving institution.
When I'm dead.
Fred.
Yeah, in addition to being... Can you hear me? Okay. In addition to being a literary schizophrenic, I'm a polygamist. Well, I'm from KZN, so it's natural that it comes with the territory. So 30 years ago, I met this lady, fell in love and got married. And she sustained me, took me places, made me kind of famous, and she was a good lady. Meanwhile, I was seeing another lady, a mistress. So it went on for about 28 years, until about 6-7 years ago. I decided to take the mistress and elevate her to the senior wife, and the senior wife to demote her to the junior status. So the one who's been demoted is journalism. The one who's been elevated is literary writing. So I've been writing, like Marita, as a journalist for a long time, but after hours, I would write a short story, send it out. Thankfully, I was published quite early as well in terms of short stories and poetry, and that gave me the impetus, the encouragement to go on. I got published in Staff Writer when I was 19, and short stories and so on. But in terms of books, I only got published in 2007, and my first book, naturally, was an autobiography. And people wondered aloud, why would a person who's not even 40 write an autobiography? Is he arrogant or what? But I grew up in KZN at a time when the province was on fire, the ANC versus Inkatha war, and I was central to that because I came from the township and I also was a journalist. I saw what was happening. So in telling this story of mine, I also tell the story of the time in KZN. So that was my first book in 2006-5. 2018, I've published 7 books, ranging from autobiography to nonfiction to 3 novels. And I write in English. But my very first book in Zulu, because I've always been scared of writing in Zulu, which funnily is my home language, but it's a very intimidating language to write in, because you have to know your stuff. So I wrote my first novel in Zulu last year. It's coming out this year. So I don't know what the Zulu academics are going to say, because I was born in a township. My Zulu is not up to standard sometime. So I'm just looking forward to the reception it's going to get. So why do I write? I write to tell the truth. And earlier on you used a very beautiful word, erasure. Erasure. You know, it's very nice to sit with people who speak English language as the first language, get new words. I've always known in erasure that you use to erase, you know, erasure, you know, removing stuff from your mind. So I write books that address erasure to bring back those stories that have been swept under the carpet back to the mainstream, as is the case with my latest novel. So I'll pause there because I can go on.
That's a bit of a difficult metaphor. It's a bit of a stretched metaphor, journalism as a lady. Alexandra.
I didn't have a choice because my mother was raised in Kenya at around the time of Beryl Markham and Out of Africa, and she thought she was at least that glamorous, and she should have her own biography, but she was too lazy to write it. So when she was pregnant with my older sister, she read my sister the entire works of Shakespeare in the womb, in the hope that my sister would hop out and be like this literary genius. And what happened was my sister was born and she's willfully illiterate. She won't read or write. She won't even, like, even her vocabulary's shaky. Like, she doesn't, she'll get close to the word, but she won't nail it. So she really frightened people by mistaking hitchhikers and hijackers. So once my mother had failed with my sister, she fixed her literary ambition on me. And I kind of didn't have a choice. And then because of the Civil War going on, they closed kindergarten. Well, they didn't let us go into kindergarten. And so the authorities in Salisbury sent correspondence packets out for the, you know, parents in rural areas with these, which I'm sure worked out for some kids. But I had my mother, and so she would get this packet, and she'd go, "Oh, well, I don't know, darling, maths, I can't do maths." And she would throw that away. She'd go, "You know what? When you grow up, you can pay someone to count for you, but you can never pay someone to write your book." And so then we would do these endless stories, and they were all about her. And I somehow managed to survive this mother and this childhood and all the rest of it. And I then left to the U.S. I met an American in Zambia, and I didn't understand anything about him. And based on that complete misunderstanding, we had a 20-year marriage, like every marriage. But I went to the States and sort of having freedom of speech. And I hadn't made a plan B for myself. I was going to be a writer. And so I wrote 10 novels, and they were all rejected. And my agent fired me. And she said, "You may have a little bit of talent, but you don't have a story." And I went, that's when I became a writer, when someone told me I couldn't do it. And so, and you know, really what I wanted to do was redress talk about erasure. There was some other, the intellectual dishonesty I felt of what had, you know, the books that I had been raised on, the sort of white narrative to make it sound like a picnic, but it never said what the underbelly of that, of that sort of oppression was. And so I wrote Don't Let's Go to the Dogs Tonight, this memoir, which really was everything. It was the drunkenness and the pedophiles down the corridors and the whole, you know, we were joking. I was like, if people had seen what we actually were as white supremacists, the whole thing would have fallen much sooner. But I was too young to get published. And so they really regretted educating me, Upshot, because it taught me to read and write, and I let all the cats out of the bag.
So the sister of whom you speak is Vanessa, also known as Mrs. Malaprop in Leaving Before the Rains Come, who at the very outset, and there are many of these instances, you speak with her over the phone from the U.S., and it's about your dad's impending but never realized, or at that juncture, not realized death. And you say, "Oh, the Bible," Vanessa said, calmly exhaling. "Oh," I said. "Well, no one in their right mind takes the Bible literally." "I do," Vanessa said. "Exactly," I triumph. "That one."
She's the one who said, "Bobo, it's going to be so awful when Dad dies. I'm not going to be able to do anything. You'll have to do the urology." So nice she's not here. We can talk about my sister some more, if you like.
Janine.
He just said Janine, and I've been hanging out with a French quite a lot lately, and they said my name the best way I could ever imagine. That's fine. I'd like to start off by Marika. You really inspire me with having more hope for my four-year-old daughter, who has a very vast imagination, and she makes stories, and story time at night, she takes over. I start when she's like, "Mommy, can I tell?" No, I'm like, yes, you may, as long as you fall asleep. So that's good. I always have a lot to say. I go off the point and I speak too much, and my husband is the one who keeps me intact and be like, stick to the point, stick to the point. And therefore, when I'm on my phone, I try to make notes in order to help me to stick to the point. So it's all about positive growth. Where it all started for me was at the age of about 11 or 12. And I have to give and pay homage to my father and my late brother, who influenced my start with writing. My father was deeply involved with politics at the time. In my upbringing as a little girl. So there was always conversations around politics and the current affairs and state of our country and our communities and so on. I also was raised with a lot of life skills in the sense that my parents didn't believe in spanking or hitting, but we have to sit around the little coffee table in our lounge and have to talk about whatever is bothering us. Whatever issues there is, let's talk about it. I was very fortunate to have that because I soon found out that many of my friends at school did not have that same value system at home. And on the other hand, I also had my four-year older brother, Mario. He was also known as a big hip-hop icon, Mr. Devious, who was murdered 14 years ago in Morganston, Mitchell's Plain. And now, just imagine for a moment, this guy, 4 years older than me, I'm 11 years old, going on 12, and he's already, for the past 4 or so years, rapping in every room in the house that he could find. He would just rap, you know, and he would rap. Rap music would be playing from either international or from POC, locally, BVK. And I would just be exposed and hear hip-hop music all around and also witness him write. You know, so around 11 or 12, I came from church one morning with my parents, got in the car, very overly emotional, got home, and started breaking down into tears. And my parents naturally asked me, what's going on? Why are you crying? And I tried as best possible to explain to them in normal terms of conversation, what I was feeling on my chest, in my head. And we did that, you know, but I still didn't feel satisfied at the end of that conversation. And I still feel like I didn't say it the way I was really feeling it. And then I went to my room, and I took out one of my school books and pencils, and I started writing. And I wrote four lines, and it was, my life is like a roller coaster. Keeps going up and down. It plays the same old tune each day. This beat goes on and on. And growing up in Mitchell's Plain, there's a lot of social ills. So that moment for me, it just all became too much. It became like the world was on my shoulders. It felt unfair. Why was I raised here? Why am I living here? What am I doing in the world like this? So cruel. And I was really angry, you know, and after writing those four lines, it really expressed what I was feeling, and I felt relieved. And that's where it all started for me. Every time I faced any issue, any triumph, any amazing love story, I would write. You know, I write. And I never really got to the depth or the value of what that really is, that I'm a writer or anything at that point. But I wrote and I wrote, and then later in my life, I got into singing as part of my healing of my brother's death. I got back into studio and I started writing and composing my first EP. And then from there, 3 years it took me to compose my album and release it, all self, independently released. So all this while, I'm writing original content from original feelings and experiences that real people can relate to. And then I went to university in the midst of all of this. So I graduated at UWC, did my postgrad in psychology and linguistics. And at the time I was like, couldn't figure why I'm doing linguistics, but obviously I loved it. I knew on the one hand it's because I love words, I'm interested to know more about the language I speak. And a couple of years later, in the midst of being a professional performing artist, and academic, and working freelancing with various youth and community development organizations, Paulsville Prison, schools, community, etc. I paused and I reflected at some point, you know, there. And then I got a call from a director, theater director, and she asked me to get involved with a musical theater production called Afrikaaps. And Afrikaaps got me to really introspect and really go through research beyond the school or university books. And I got to find out where the way, the type of Afrikaans I speak, where it comes from, you know. And through that journey, I felt empowered, I felt liberated, I felt more proud of the way I speak Afrikaans. And the spark started with, yay, it's time to write. Wait, before that happened, in the midst of Afrikaaps was a lot of invitations to literary festivals. Amongst panel discussions like this, and everyone has books, and I'm invited to these festivals, and I don't have a book. And then I just got tired of that, and I said, okay, next step in my journey is getting my book out there, met with publishers. It's a story I left in the past. but I parked the whole project after research and meetings with publishers and didn't go well. And I just parked that whole project of getting my book out. Then my daughter was born about 4 years ago, and that project just came back up. And my book was born after her birth, soon after, in 2015, in fact. And I self-published, and my book was titled, or is titled, Karada. So Karada is a very Kaapse Afrikaans word that means Kaida, look there. And I'm very proud of that. But to the moment I got to that point of, I'm going to get my book out there. I'm going to compile all my writing or as many as I feel comfortable getting out there in public. That's where I think, aha, I'm stepping over a threshold. I think I'm going there. So, thank you.
Simon.
Yeah, I think every colored I know is a writer, you know. When we speak, we have the subtitles going. You know, he's busy writing as he's talking the whole time. you know, for me, I don't know. You know, we probably have to redefine the idea of a writer or author, you know, especially in the day and age where we are now, in terms of the people who blog, people who, the Facebook posts and everything, people follow the stories and the narratives and stuff. Because to me, you know, where I grew up, everybody's loud. Amal Pati, Amal Prad, Hart, Amal Prad, Diamaka. I have a show on RSG. It's a shameless plug, you know. It's Mondays evenings. But what we did is, it's just me and a friend of mine, and this is, I want to substantiate this. It's me and a friend of mine, one mic in the middle, and we just say, okay, the topic tonight is anger. And then I start recording, and it's a whole cacophony. Van Diamaka, Prad, and stuff. But I wanted to showcase that, the sanity in that. But what I found in literature is my people were just silent there, you know. It's so hard. They speak so loud. They have so much stuff to say. And the writers in my family is my grandmother, Auntie Oma Annie. You know, I had the privilege of sharing the eulogy there. And I was standing there. And I had this thing written. And the vrommelik het net so op. And I threw it out there. It's in the Roman Catholic Church. And I started freestyling, you know, because she never was educated. But she taught me hip-hop. She taught me rhyming. She taught me how to educate people with rhyming without being, you know, illiterate then. She was illiterate to the author, people who has kind of author glasses on. So for me, that was the authors. My father's an author. All of them, nobody made matric or whatever. But I think I'm just an observer, and I just felt that I wanted to share the stories and genuine. I wanted to share it on a genuine level and on an honest level. And as a kid, I think I was like 8 or 9 when I first listened to Anneli van Rooyen, and it was a beautiful song, Blay Bay May. And the chorus part, it says,
Blay, blay, blay. Let it go. And as a kid, I was there. What is she saying there? I was listening. Because I was sitting in front of the speaker and I was listening. And then she say, Latigyo Yungan Mark. And I thought she wants to mark something with this guy. It's probably adult stuff, you know. And I was drawn in by what was said. And it's still today. I'm a very keen observer. I try to listen. I try to resolve and understand. And what goes on in my head, I try to share. So obviously, I write music. I love music. I think that was the first thing that drew me into the idea of writing. But now I'm not a writer. I'm a typist, you know. And so for me, it's just important to share what I consider truth right now. You understand? Because I think that is a bit lacking in the world currently for me. And especially the colloquialism, or I don't want to share this as colloquialism, but for me it's Afrikaans. The fact that it's so young, it's a young language, and the sounds are not included. The phonetics of Afrikaans is not inclusive at the moment. We know about the dictionary of it, but the phonetics. And I want to see how do we write these phonetics down, the sound of the language, and that's my purpose currently. So even in my short story that was out this year, It's how do you write the rapper's tone when we write and we start battling and we use the double negatives and stuff. Who decides that? So I'm currently deep into that, the roots of the language of Afrikaans per se. And that's the first thing I want to share because it loosens the confidence of my people to share their stories. Because they're not sure. Because if they open their mouth and they write it in that way, it's either sy's van die plaas af, moenie so praat nie, or sy klink soos 'n skollie. It's either one of those two, and that takes the confidence away from their pens and their mouths. So for me, I just want to share it like that, and I actually moved to Joburg to sit down with the editors, because a lot of the words in my book, I needed to define myself, and even the writing of it, the spelling of it, it was important. So I think I'm just there now. But I still have, obviously, a lot to share.
So in other words, that's a coded message to the arts journalists in the room to expect a cover LP or whatever titled Ek Lewe.
Ek Lewe. I'm still Ek Lewe.
Surely that's a very good idea. You can pay me a commission. I think it's so well. Now, the intriguing theme that listening carefully to all of you that emerges, that really intrigues me, in a different way, but in every one of your contributions, is the notion of, and I use this word in its broad sense, translation, either between two languages or two places or and really mainly those two. I mean, you've just, Simon, spoken, and you too, in a sense of translating within a language. Specifically you, Simon, made that very pertinent. You know, you need to, somehow your Afrikaans doesn't pass muster. Marita lives in France. Eben lives in Australia. I'm not sure what language they speak there. It's certainly not English. But Fred has spoken about writing awkwardly, if that's a correct characterization, for the first time in his mother tongue, having been so acculturated to writing in English. Alexandra, you live, albeit in an English language country, but you...
No, I don't translate. I transgress. I'm transgression. That's my... all about.
But you do write about a world that... interestingly, he's a bit like Charlie, ex-husband's grandmother in Wyoming. Zambia and Zimbabwe sounds a little like Wyoming in a sense, but you do write about a place that isn't known to, I think, many of your readers. And in a sense, that is common to, and I can go through each of you, but I think that is, certainly it's an intriguing theme to my ear that has emerged. And I want us perhaps to just explore that a bit. And we're not going to do the run as we did now. I'm going to turn up, as it were, the the order a bit. Masande, I'm going to start with you. And if I make an incorrect assumption, you'll correct me, but English is not your first language,
no,
is it?
No.
So you write in a language which is very different to the one that you would have spoken at the breakfast and the dinner table at home.
Yeah.
What is that like? Why and how?
It's actually got quite a... I suppose it's very storied in a sense. It's linked to what I said earlier, I guess, about kind of my parents' pursuit, you know, for what they perceived to kind of be this idea of the better education leading off to like better prospects in life, etc., and kind of working their way towards that. And so that's one of the things that we had to do from a very young age. You had to have a very strong facility with this language. And of course, you grow up in such a way in that you encounter it for the first time and it's completely foreign, right? And it's something that you have to learn. And so there's so much cultural pressure around it. And it actually feels completely normal. And so you pick it up, actually. And it's actually quite funny because when I was in high school, I remember I used to, because I was reading a lot at the time, you know, as a way to kind of adjust to this new environment, I went to a very Anglican, like, very kind of strange boys' school setup thing. At some point for high school, right? And so, I was reading a lot at the time, and I guess doing really well in English. And it's kind of like the same question that I would get from like my classmates who did actually have it as a first language. And they'd kind of question me about whether or not, you know, do your parents, like, speak to you in this language? Or, like, did you grow up with it? Like, why are you getting higher grades than us? I'm like, I don't know. I read the material. I mean, it's high school. but it's been very interesting, you know, because you finish matric, right? And you go to university and suddenly... the books that you read, the scope is kind of broadened. Like when I was doing my undergrad and I was an English major, you suddenly are exposed to all this literature, you know, from South Africa as well as from the rest of the continent. And you're also exposed to like the literary criticism around it. So you start reading up on things like the language debates, you know, you start reading up on Ngugi wa Thiong'o talking about decolonizing the mind and, you know, and how like Chinua Achebe was kind of opposed to him on that topic. And yeah, so I went through that as well. And even though I'd been writing before, I became even more suspicious of language when I was an undergraduate. And I guess my writing kind of slowed down because it felt like you had to be ostensibly like opposed to like, you know, this language, which was kind of an instrument of colonization. So that kind of took me on a detour for a while until I started realizing that actually, you know, it's not that my parents brought me up speaking English, but it was definitely a language that was spoken at home. My dad was a lecturer at a technicon, and my mother was a journalist who wrote in English. And so I started kind of coming to terms with the fact that this was a language that I would use in my work, especially seeing as that I'd read so much literature in English, and so much had been translated, which allowed me to be able to read Japanese writers or Russian writers or South American writers. But when it became really interesting for me was discovering that you could write in the language, but also you could kind of bend it in a way, or at least foreground a kind of friction that exists in like a South African English where it's rubbing up against all these other languages, right? And I kind of try to recreate that in my novel, The Reactive, just in terms of, and I remember I had this conversation with my US publishers, for example, because it was incredibly difficult to translate this to them, that it felt really awkward for a character who's Xhosa to say in Mthatha as opposed to Mthatha, you know. And it was things like that came up, not necessarily translating it into another language, but translating it into a place where the English language had a different reality and a different history. So that was interesting for me. And I mean, it's set in Cape Town. I managed to get closer words, Afrikaans words. And so definitely for me, the idea of translating English is kind of like quintessentially South African.
As your character Ruan says, Nuit.
Yeah. Yeah. I had to explain what that means. And there was another, actually, when it was getting translated into Italian, my publisher there, was also my editor, had this idea that Afrikaans is basically every language that's not English in South Africa.
A notion shared surely by some locally. Yeah.
And I had to tell them, look, I mean, in terms of the etymology, there might be similarities, but this is slang, and it's not Afrikaans, actually. And in fact, its roots are in Zulu or in Xhosa. Yeah. It was quite interesting.
Marita, you live in a place where, other than on the internet and over the telephone, I'd imagine pretty little Afrikaans is spoken, and I think your life to some measure is documented in magazines.
Pretty little English even is spoken.
Oh, even English. Well, how is that? How is that to sustain specifically, and you write novels, albeit literary in nature, Kowak or Scott had a colloquial bent to it. So really you need to, in order to write a novel like that, which subsequently became a film, you really have to have the ear, the sort of cadence of Afrikaans. How the hell, forgive me, do you do that in a small French hamlet? How do you maintain that Afrikaans ear?
Well, one word, internet. And second word, frequent visits. I wouldn't have been able to do it maybe 20, 30 years ago, but now I can listen to a podcast of RSG, Radio Sonder Grense, in my French village. I can read all the Afrikaans newspapers on internet. I can listen through YouTube. I can listen to Afrikaans music. There are some Afrikaans music that I really like and some I don't want to listen to. But so really that is a thing that's constantly there. But then I do think that to really, and I suppose Eben would agree with me there, and Alexandra, you too probably, to really keep in touch with what's happening in a place, I think you have to physically also be there as frequently as possible to smell the smells and feel the feel and just sit anywhere in a cafe and hear, listen, be the fly on the wall, because that you can't pick up on internet, and really listen to how the language changes, and I love doing that. So I think it's probably in the compliment for me, but if you think I can manage it, but that is what all writers do. Don't we? We listen to how people speak.
And you mentioned Eben, and of course Eben has lived abroad, not probably for longer than you. Say, well, 1986, you said Eben, the same date as Etienne, the central character in Didier, the spool of Fanny, moves to England out of no choice of his own. Eben, you wrote the very interesting novel. You've written several interesting novels, but My Sympathie Cerise, to me, was very interesting when I read it roughly at the time. Was because it was an Afrikaans novel written in and about Australia. And the central, certainly there was some Irish in it, but it was a novel set in sort of upper class suburban Australia through medium Afrikaans. That utterly intrigued me at the time. It required a sort of dislocation, both from the writer and from the reader, to because Afrikaans is such a tribal language. It's so specific to here. How did you do that? And in a sense, of course, in your most recent novel, So Groen Soos die Hemel Daarboe, you did exactly the same. How do you do that? Hoe werkt dit?
I'm not sure if the register actually worked in that novel, My Sympathie Cerise. I don't think I should have ever published that novel. But I think, I'm not sure if I'm answering your question, but for me it was a shocking thing to emigrate, you know. I felt very much dislocated from everything here that I loved and hated, and that I had emotional ties to, and suddenly I was, you know, in Sydney, where people do actually speak English. And I think then I started, I love Afrikaans and all its crazy words like Holders the Bolder and Bolle Makisi. And I would always collect these words, which somehow over there sound different, and it's as if they have more weight and a different sense. And then I felt I have to write something to try and make sense of a part of my life here, but fictionalize it. And so then I think I wrote my first novel, Foxtrot van die Vleiseters. So for me, my writing in Afrikaans and now in English, it's, and I think it always has been, a way of making sense of not only my own life, but also a part of what's happening here and elsewhere.
So out of interest, you wrote Foxtrot when you were already there?
Yeah.
Okay, and I think you, my own diffident opinion is you're unduly harsh on My Sympathie Cerise. I found it utterly charming, but you may differ.
Thank you.
Fanny, you were a lawyer for a long time, and in a different country in the U.S., certainly, and in, you studied in the U.S. and in England, and you practiced, I think, mainly in England. So you, and as a lawyer, presumably you wrote a lot of English, you used English. How does it? And you did say initially you'd written as a young man before you entered the sort of world of hard knocks. But how do you, for such a period, 15 years or so, sustain such an intimate sort of engagement with Afrikaans? Because on reading Didier de Spoel, rereading it, in fact, earlier today, bits of it, you've got a voice a little bit, and I'm not trying to flatter you, although flattering it might be, but you sound a little bit like an Afrikaans Alan Hollinghurst. There's a sort of, there's a sort of poetry in your prose. But how on earth do you get back to that sort of level of prose writing in a language from which you were divorced for so long? Mm. I mean, is it a really studied, engaged process? Do you, like Eben, collect words, use the dictionary, revisit sort of texts? How do you do it?
No, divorce it certainly was for a very long time. I'm not quite sure I can answer your question in a very in a simple way. I think the archives of the mind work in strange ways, and unlike Marita, I didn't, you know, at the time, first when I lived in the U.S., lived and worked in the U.S. and then in the U.K., I had barely any contact with other South Africans, or at least certainly Afrikaans-speaking ones, just not because I was necessarily actively avoiding it, but simply because I was started working for an American law firm and then went to London and worked for an American law firm. So essentially, I think the Afrikaans was entirely dormant for something like 17 years. And it's something about the energy of suppression about it, I think. Odd things happened to the Afrikaans, I think, in that period when I didn't speak it, so hardly ever spoke it, perhaps once a, you know, once a month on the telephone and once a year for a few days in South Africa. I'm trying to figure out what happened to it. I think perhaps, and you may know this as well, but if one studies in certain places in the UK and if you work in the professional world there, where in certain professional spheres, then you often work with people who have this kind of a fantasy of Elizabethan English just below the surface. So there's often a kind of overly formal English is being spoken. And possibly something of that sort of work back to the dormant Afrikaans, I don't know. And then there's, as I say, the energy of suppression, the fact that suddenly it just re-emerges. I'm not quite sure where from. I did read quite a bit of Afrikaans, and I used to, the times that I did travel to South Africa, I would take back a little stack of Afrikaans books. So something of that was at work, you know, at a subconscious level, perhaps. And then there's, as I said, there's the re-emergence, as if one, you know, digs in a garden and finds an old toy. And then I think one's new approach to Afrikaans then, after such a long time, is somewhat different. It, you approach it almost like a second language with a sort of hyper-consciousness. It's there's a certain foreignness about it that, and the engagement with that foreignness releases a certain kind of energy. There's a certain tectonic movement, I think, catalyzed by that.
Now, Janine to my right warns me that she will soon be making a Cinderella move, and she doesn't want her glass slipper to be, or her to be pursued across the kingdom. So I'm going to give Janine you a chance. You spoke earlier about sort of recognizing the sort of important juncture at which you recognized the Afrikaans that you knew when you saw, well, that was also a literary mode, a mode of literary expression. Who were the Afrikaans writers, if any, that you read as a younger person? If you say that, you know, you needed to find expression in your Afrikaans, were there any Afrikaans writers that, or singers, or artists that you sort of could draw upon?
Not many that I was exposed to, in all honesty, besides the hip-hoppers, you know, like POC, like I say, Bivika, Devious, and some others. And then Yemo Biasum I met later, Bafok, the lyricist, authors, you know, that's not recognized in the mainstream society as specific, like, writers or popular artists and that kind of thing back in the day. So yes, as a child, I wasn't exposed to much Afrikaans literature, especially the type of Afrikaans I speak. The so-called, like we were taught in school, the literature was as so-called safer Afrikaans. And I had a big issue with it because I could never really relate. And I always felt uncomfortable expressing myself in that type of Afrikaans. And, you know, so No, there wasn't many that I could, that I was exposed to. Only late in my life when I was more confident and older and a bit wiser, I could take, you know, control of that in my life in terms of choosing who and what I want to read. And then I also obviously make the conscious decision to change that so that I can be an active contributor to other young people in today's time who are searching for that literature that they can relate to. And hence, that's why my book, Karada, is where it is today. And I wasn't going to wait to be appropriated or to be accommodated in order to make this happen. It was purely to change the status quo, purely to change the situation in our communities in terms of waiting and then also lacking behind because, Thank you so much for the opportunity to be here, and I sincerely apologize that I have to rush off. I'm running late already for another event, international event I'm judging at, and I have to apologize there as well. So please,
thank you. Popularity is not a bad thing.
Panelists and audience organizers, thank you for having me. Keep up the good work. Thank you.
Valda, we've been hearing now in a sense echoes a bit of what you spoke about earlier. You spoke about not finding on the Afrikaans shelves in the bookshop the book that you really wanted to write and that you realized over time that in fact you needed to write that book. Yet, ironically, and perhaps tongue-in-cheekly, you might correct me, the title of your book, of course, resonates very clearly, I would have thought, to Hetty Smith's "Hy kom met die sekelman," "Hy kom met die skoenlappers." Was that intentional? And more, perhaps importantly, despite the fact that you were looking for your book on the shelves, were there those that nevertheless you had read before, that even though they mightn't have fully satisfied you, that you, in a sense, respond to?
Okay, the title came afterwards. I had a few ideas, and I wanted to name the book. The book is in three separate parts, and one of those parts is called Blank Blank Gelede. And I came upon that title just in my mind. I was in my house, and I wasn't working on the book, but I was writing. Over many years, I was writing bits and pieces. And I was in my kitchen, and I saw the newspaper on the table, upside down. And I thought I saw Blank Blank Gelede upside down. So I ran across and to look at the newspaper, and I looked at the newspaper, and it wasn't there. The words weren't there. But I knew that I saw those words, and I wrote those words down. But that was quite a few years ago. So I had that with me all these years. But of course, that title wasn't going to work on a book on the Afrikaans shelf. Who was going to buy that book? So I put it inside the book, and we worked with something else like En die tyd van die skoenlappers, because it's about, there's this one scene about the butterflies and the migration of the butterflies through Johannesburg and upwards to the rest of the continent and over the ocean. And it was that image for me of butterflies just going somewhere. And most of them don't make it, but they go nevertheless. So we worked with that title, and it was just before the book was going to be published that someone came up with that title, Haikomediskunlappers, because when there were proofreaders reading the manuscript, and some of them mentioned that it reminds them of Hetty Smith's book, Comedy Circle Man. So just before it was published, that title came up, and Nalika, the publisher, called me and told me about that and what do I think of it. So I thought about it during that night, and I couldn't sleep, so I went downstairs and I sat in the lounge thinking about that title. If I am satisfied with the title, but I thought, yes, I am, because I wanted something with spunk to grip you when you see it. Oh, the other thing that you asked me was about Afrikaans and books. So Marita is sitting here, and Marita was one of the authors that I've lived with her books. I've lived with Anke Kroch, and I've lived with Ingrid Jonker. I've lived with N.P. van Wyklou, Adam Small, S.V. Peterson. All of those people, everybody. I read them when I was at school. I went to the library every afternoon after school. I came home with stacks of books, and I read everything that I could land my hands on. But the thing about the literature was not that I wanted, I didn't know what I wanted, but I did not feel myself in that literature, in those books, and what was written about Afrikaans literature. I didn't feel myself there, and I sensed that I was outside of that literature, and that was the issue for me, that I was outside that literature, and I didn't want to be out. I wanted to be inside of the Afrikaans literature. I wanted to place myself there. I grew up in a house in the Strand. I was born in the Eastern Cape. My parents are from the Eastern Cape. I grew up in an Afrikaans house. And my parents spoke what was called suiwer Afrikaans, a suiwer Ooskaapse Afrikaans. And that was the language that I grew up with. And when we came to Cape Town, to the Strand, we came to live here, we encountered Kaapse Afrikaans, and my father didn't like it. And we couldn't speak that at home. But I have three brothers who are younger than myself, and they speak it. I can also speak Kaapse Afrikaans, and I can read it, but I don't. That is not, I don't write Kaapse Afrikaans, and that is just my issue.
Thank you, Valda. Now, we're now in that stage of the award ceremony where the music's going to start rumbling. Elmarie's there standing, so you're the equivalent of the drums rolling time. I want to give each of the three of you, haven't had a second spreekbeurt, indeed a spreekbeurt, but I'm going to, let's make it a, rather than a postcard, a postage stamp. Fred, the intriguing theme of you writing for the first time, while you've written many, many titles in English in your mother tongue, and you set out in brief terms the sort of how perplexed it rendered you. I mean, how different is it? Is your audience entirely different? What was the process like, having become established as a writer in English, now to write in your mother tongue for the first time?
Thank you. Maybe the question should be, I'm a journalist, you see, I ask questions. Maybe the question you should be asking me...
Fair enough.
...is why didn't I write in Zulu in the first place? When I was growing up, I went to school at a time when Bantu education was at its most virulent. I grew up in the township, raised there, went to a township school. But the books that we read in Zulu were all set in rural areas. They were supposed to tell us to love the idyllic Zulu past, to go back intellectually, psychologically, to the past that has been taken away from us by colonialism. Now, apartheid education was saying we should be happy to go back to our homelands. So hence the prescription of these texts that we are reading. I couldn't relate to them because I can't milk a cow. They were telling us about those things. So naturally, I resisted reading those books and even writing in that language, even though I struggled as well with the English language at another level. So now that things are kind of normalizing, I would say, there's a growth in the reading market for African languages. For example, the most successful daily language newspaper in the country is Isolezwe in Zulu. So it is setting the tone, and it's given me the confidence to go back and confront the ghost of my language, which I rebelled against because of the status quo of the time. So I'm still learning my own language, so to speak, in terms of writing. And the issue of writing in English has been very interesting for me. I went to a Bantu education school up to matric, and the people who were supposed to teach us English, they themselves struggled with the language. So sometimes they would resort to teaching us English grammar in Zulu. That's how tragic it was at some stage. So, and then for some funny reason, I think the apartheid state had a very beautiful and morbid sense of humor. People who are struggling with that English language are made to read Shakespeare and Thomas Hardy. Unabridged version, the original version of Thomas Hardy, there was a bias in his gait. What the hell does that mean? We had to, there was a bias in his gait. In English, it means he was drunk, he couldn't walk properly.
And Simon, you proclaim as the title of your book, God Praat Afrikaans. Now, we've heard from yourself and Janine, who's left us, that there are many Afrikaansers. What does the title mean? What Afrikaans does God supposedly speak?
Yeah, it's contextual. It's for me, it's more a love and appreciation for who I am and what I dream. Whether it's a dry dream or it's always Afrikaans. I can idolize Angelina Jolie or Charlize Theron or whatever. But when I dream about them, I speak to them in Afrikaans in my dreams. Yeah? And it's the same with when I fight my ideas of love, every affection that I've ever felt. It comes to me through my language. So the upper echelon of feeling and appreciation and all of these aspects of life comes to me and echoes in my mother tongue. And my mother tongue is Afrikaans, but it is really it's really stated in the book in such a way that I understand and appreciate the various versions of this language. I don't really like the idea of a categorization of, say, Kaaps or whatever, or Afrikaaps or whatever, the Namakwala. I just feel that everything should be included. It's a very young language, so I wrote it in that way. I wrote it in such a way so that the purist can listen and read it and understand, but I give them portions of other languages. I'm a Namakwala, because a Namakent. And it's so important to bring those cliques in. I mean, we bring out a series of children's books this year, me and Wendy, for great R's, and really to introduce the cliques to read Nga. My brew is Nga. You know, it's so important for the growth of the language to include the sounds. And I'm very focused on that at the moment. And the book for me is just whatever the highest power might be in this world and age, it came to me in Afrikaans. And it's a memoir boasting as an autobiography. It's really just a memoir of my observations in the language.
Thank you. And there's a little clip going around. I'm not sure whether you've seen it of Charlize and a Nigerian actor she teaches him some Afrikaans and he teaches her some Yoruba. And certainly she knows the meaning of the word stukkie. Yeah. She claims never to have been one, but she knows its meaning. Yeah. Now, Alexandra, you write from suburban, not suburban, well, from the U.S.,
I live in a yurt. I don't have plumbing. I chop my own wood. A wolf killed a deer in the meadow outside. I rejected suburban America
as hard as I could.
Yes, yeah.
Okay, so you live and write in the U.S., But who's your audience? Obviously, it's a wide audience because you write, you write utterly beautifully and you're very, very funny. You've obviously got, and I know you have a wide audience, you must have, like Peter Godwin, a sort of expat audience, but you obviously have a very wide, who do you write to when you sit down to write? Do you have an audience in mind? How does that work?
The most terrifying phone call of my life was, "Hi, Mom, your dreams come true. I'm published." And then I was like, God. And then she goes, "What's the book about?" And I said, "The line's gone bad." And I hung up. I mean, it's terrifying to write these memoirs and then face everyone. And then for me, and it's so typical of me, having written all these memoirs and incurred the wrath of everyone who raised me, we had a neighbor who was so angry with the book I wrote. I don't blame him. I called his father a pedophile and named him. But he said if I ever came home, he would chop me up into tiny little pieces and feed me to the crocodiles in the Kafue River. And my parents made sure to invite him for lunch every time I come home. And then, as if that wasn't enough, I took on the oil companies because although Wyoming sells itself as a cowboy state, it's not. It's a natural gas and oil state. And they just throw heartbeats at rigs. And if they kill them, so what? It's a right-to-work state. They change the rules and they just, you know. And I'm from here where if you smell an injustice, you're allowed to say something. Taking on the oil in Wyoming, I got death threats. I got so many death threats, my kid would hand the phone over. He'd be like, "Oh, this person, no, it's my mom you want. Hold on. Oh, wait, good luck." And then hand over the phone. So I think, I mean, for me, it was about always, I think this has come up over and over again, I want to say something true. And it's not about sitting in some comfortable suburban remove. It would be for me so revolting and a contamination. For me, it's a dismantling. Every book that I do undoes the person that wrote it. It must. And that next book undoes and undoes and undoes. And I am getting down there. I live in a yurt, 27 round feet. So next book, it'll be dog shed and rabbit hutch. But there must be something in it that, I mean, if you are being honest about the dismantling of the work itself, then it should reflect in your body. It's a thing. And for me, to deconstruct what it meant to be white and to come out of the violence of my childhood means I don't really know that I get to go and own property on Indian land in Wyoming because those people have not sorted out their problems either. And I don't want to go and contribute more. And I think it's very difficult as a white settler to stand up and talk about deconstructing the, you know, this racism that incarcerates the highest number of people anywhere, mostly black people, and the highest number of indigenous people who also fight for the armed forces of the U.S. in highest proportion, and also be living in a suburban America and sort of following the American dream. You either deconstruct the thing or you don't, not both, one or the other, for me.
Thank you. thank you and thank all of you. I certainly enjoyed it. I hope you did, and I hope you and the audience did. Thank you very much to all of those, all of you writers who joined us this evening. It was enormous fun. Thank you.